This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Coming to the bat for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys talk about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
And good night, thank you, and welcome to the one talk show in America that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life. And a guy with a long life expectancy in the house, Johnny Dean. How's your life?
What life? How can I have a long life expectancy and no life at the same time?
That's why you have a long life expectancy. It's God punishing you.
Punishing me? I like to be busy. No, I'm a busy guy. Idle hands and all that stuff. That's not my style.
Are you getting ready for a big podcast where you bring your keyboard in and we do some songs?
Yeah, I got the fingers warmed up and all that stuff. So
we'll keep you posted on that, folks, because we got a lot of we got our chops down.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff to talk about, things that just there's enough time in the hour to get to.
Yeah, so on that subject, we will get to this life expectancy thing. Also, Steve Vernon wrote not too long about the losing a spouse being the hardest thing for married people. Obviously, that is true. And so many people don't realize the risks associated with that. Financial risk. Obviously, the emotional risks are beyond even imagination. But the financial risks are also there, and a lot of people don't plan for that, and it is inevitable. Usually, the woman will last longer than us men, John.
Yeah, and there are all kinds of other problems associated with that, too.
Lots and lots of them. Solving the biggest risk in retirement, this whole idea of longevity. But we start today with life expectancy growing with age. A lot of people make the mistake of thinking that the life expectancy tables that you utilize, that the actuaries give us, is really going to impact how long you might live, which would be true if we were having this discussion and you were like 3 or 4 weeks old. But we're having this discussion and you're 40, 50, 60, 70, whatever, and your life expectancy will grow with age. Sit back, folks. Relax. It's the Ray Revolution!
Almost there. Right there. That's good.
Wade Powell wrote about this a while back. It's good stuff, and it's something that everybody needs to be cognizant of. Here's what he said, and he's got an illustration. You all can't see it, but Johnny Dean can. And the illustration looks something like that, John. And
well, yes, if you're listening on the radio, you can't see it, but it looks like an obtuse triangle.
Yeah, okay.
How's that?
Uh-huh.
An obtuse angle, maybe.
An obtuse angle is very, very good. So what he says is when you're using median life expectancies, there's a 50% probability that you'd live past that age of life expectancy. So if a person's 65 years old, they have a 50% chance of living 21.85 more years to right about age 87, he says. But there's also a 50% chance you could live longer than that. So there's this line that you saw, that one line that was steep, that was taking you from 65 to 87 and you're dead. And then there was a line that sort of curved out.
Starting from the same point.
Exactly. And that said, well, you know what? You also, if you make it, say, to age 87, there's a 50% chance you're going to make it to 90. And if you make it to 90, there's a 50% chance you're going to make it to 95, and so forth. So this is why when we get to the greatest risk that retirees and pre-retirees must face, it's the mere fact that you don't know when you're going to kick the bucket. And therefore, it makes planning very, very critical, because when we go back to these 4% rules, you know, the Bill Benjamin 4% rule, they have to use a worst case scenario, don't they? Because they have to make the assumption that you're going to outlive your life expectancy, therefore be more conservative with their assumptions. so that they look at 1,000 different scenarios, and in 4 or 5 of them you run out of money. So they say, whoa, we got to be careful. We got to make sure we're not going to run out of money. So here is what Faust said about this. This, he says, explains why it's a big mistake to use life expectancies at birth when thinking about how long one will live in their retirement. Once one has reached their retirement age, they should live much longer than their life expectancy at birth because they were not a part of the population that died before the retirement age. Sounds pretty logical to me. If you made it to the age of 87 and you're still alive, you're looking in the mirror and you say, you know what? I'm going to make it another X number of years, right?
Well, okay, think about it this way. I like to look at it this way. In 1900, I think the average, the life expectancy was somewhere around 63, 64.
45, I think, in 19. Maybe it was a little bit more than that, but
it was something like that. Maybe 60-something, 70, 63, something like that. All right, so obviously a lot of people died off early. But those who made it to 63, 64, 65 had, because there was not much medical care and all that other stuff, they had really good genes that kept them alive. So that 65-year-old oftentimes made it all the way to 90. You had people back then living to be 90, 95, in spite of the fact that there wasn't any medical care. They just had good genes. They had inherited good stuff. So you can see this again. It still holds true today. If you're going to make it to age 80 or 85, there's a good chance that you're going to make it another 5 years, 10 years.
There's a good chance. My dad, who is 93 and a half, almost 94 years old, will likely make it another, according to the odds, 5 years.
Those are the odds. That's the odds maker.
Well, there's a 50% chance that he could make it another 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So that being said, how do you plan for a lifetime of income? So now we go back to solving the biggest risk in retirement, which I teased in the last hour, I believe, but who knows when this might air. But it's very interesting because this fellow, David Braun, wrote, when it comes to financially preparing for retirement, of course, we may have many risks to address. And we've covered all of these from time to time on the show, for sure, such as long-term care risk, yep, market risk, of course, withdrawal rate risk, sequence of returns risk, mortality risk, inflation risk, deflation risk, regulatory risk, fluctuating tax risk, health risks in particular can be life-changing as they affect your memory, mobility, and basic functions such as vision and hearing. Okay.
That sounds scary. That sounds very scary.
Longevity risk, he goes on, however, is chief among all the risks because it's a risk multiplier. And this is the point that you have to really be cognizant of. The longer you live, the bigger all those other risks get, don't they? So if it were so simple, if you go back to 1900 and you die at age 60, most of those people didn't have to worry about long-term care because they were 6 feet under.
Well, their long-term care was about a year and a half when they couldn't work anymore. They went to live with, you know, their kids or something, and they died in bed a year later.
That's right. So looking at various insurance products that satisfy the need, and this is the point that I was making earlier. When we look at like losing a spouse or dying too soon or living too long, insurance is one of the only ways that you can reasonably satisfy or solve for that particular problem. And that's true whether we're talking about annuitized income. You buy insurance to make sure you don't run out of money before you run out of life, right? And you buy insurance in the unlikely event you were to die prematurely. You're in that 50% that either die before age 87, and in that case, a life insurance policy might kick in. Or if you're lucky enough to live beyond your life expectancy, you buy insurance to make sure that you have an income stream that will last as long as you do. This is basic in all financial planning, yet ignored by most financial planners, and it's a dang shame.
Why is it ignored by financial, many, not all, many?
I'll tell you why. Because over the years, it didn't used to be, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the insurance industry was a classic industry, and that's where most of the financial planners came from,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, so that was on their mind.
So they had risk management training. Today, it's all about AUM.
Assets under management.
Right, because if I can get your money and put it under management, 70% of the time, I'm getting a raise. I'm getting an increase in my compensation for not having to do that much more, right?
Yes.
So insurance, it usually pays you one time and then you're done, right? So we'll talk more about this on the other side, but stick around. I got a lot more coming your way right here on the Ray Lucia Show. Welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show. Every time I hear the song, I think of Sam Kinison.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Good old Sam.
Great. Preacher Sam.
It was also in that movie, was it Major League, I think? Was it not?
Yeah, I think it was
a character they called Wild Thing.
Yeah,
or
Wild
something.
Thing.
Yeah. Anyway.
Welcome back to the Ray Lucia Show, 844-RAY-SHOW. If you want to chat, this is the hour to call. If you want to get on board, emails at raylucia.com, RAYLUCIA.com. Click on the Ask Ray button. If you email me right now, we'll get to it in the email segment. So we've been talking a little bit about risk management today, and we'll get into the psychology of retirement satisfaction. An interesting study by someone I've also quoted many times on this show, Dr. Michael Fink, CFP, chief academic officer. You see, if you say that fast, it turns
cheek academic. Yes, all right.
At the American College of Financial Services from Texas Tech. In either event, Steve Vernon, who is an actuary, wrote not too long ago about the loss of a spouse, and he was quoting from the Merrill Lynch Age Wave study titled "Widowhood: The Loss Couples Rarely Plan For and Should." You see, on this program, we're going to bring up the tough stuff that your advisor probably refuses to talk to you about because you don't make much money. There's no AUM involved in risk management. But losing a spouse is by far the hardest thing for married people to do. Here's what Mr. Vernon said. If you need some motivation to take action, consider this. More than 3/4 of people who've lost a spouse said it's the single hardest thing they've ever been through. In addition, half of all such people experienced a household decline in income of 50% or more, and 2/3 said adjusting to this income loss is their top financial concern. Almost 2/3 of those who've lost a spouse said at the beginning of their grief they were overwhelmed with an onslaught of paperwork and didn't know where to start. Now, John, you and I have been talking about your financial advisor providing you with a place to store all of your important documents. We talked about account aggregation as a means of getting all of your accounts centrally located in one place on a computer that's basically locked away on the cloud and only you and your designees have access to it. This is critically important, and if your advisor doesn't offer this service, I highly suggest you find one that does.
I've heard it said even by my wife, hey, if something happened to you, I wouldn't even know where to log in. I don't even know what accounts we have, because she's turned it over to me years ago. It's been my duty to do all that. And I don't
mind. I'm going to have a little sit-down with y'all, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, we have talked about it, and she understands it, but she says, I don't even know.
She's the principal of a school of higher education, John.
Yes. Yes, she is. But she doesn't want to deal with numbers and budgets. She does that at school.
So we need to get you on a system where all of this stuff can be stored for your entire financial plan, all of your tax returns, all of your important documents, wills, trusts, all that stuff. And by the way, folks, if you want information on this, then you can get a hold of us. Go to RayLucia.com. We don't do it, but we can refer you to someone that actually does this for a living.
Think of somebody who's in their 70s that has five or six, you know, as a 401k, a few IRAs and all that stuff, and they're in required minimum distribution age. Well, and they're single, they die, their heirs inherit an IRA. Maybe they don't know where the account is. They don't know if they've taken an RMD. They don't even know how much is in there.
You know, I've had situations back in the day when I was doing financial planning where people would die, they have life insurance policies, and they don't know where they are. They didn't even know they had them. I remember years ago,
yes.
I was sending letters out to MetLife and Prudential and all the major companies saying, by the way, so-and-so, Johnny Dean died, and I'm working with Chris Dean, and she told John to get themselves financially organized, and it was so stressful, he up and died of a heart attack. So do you have a policy? Some guy named John Dean. There's probably 900,000 of them around the country.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there were three of them died yesterday, as a matter
right,
of fact.
Right, exactly.
Now, it's you know, and how do you know? Was there an insurance policy on Uncle Charlie or Grandpa or somebody? They don't know.
So there's other things that you need to know because of the Social Security claiming. Mm-hmm. You know, a widow has the ability to claim Social Security at age 60. There's loss of pension benefits. By the way, on the Social Security side, there's going to be a loss of one or the other Social Security benefits. So how do you plan for that? Well, that's one of the reasons why I am the proud owner of an HP 12C Platinum.
Well, the Platinum, well.
Calculator, because it's easy to do present value calculations. My question is, do you have any kind of a plan? Has anybody sat down with you? And I used to like doing it. I put together a whole training program on a yellow tablet once for advisors, because I came to the conclusion that this is back, you know, when computers were just coming out.
Or even before. I remember it was, I remember that. It had a name for it.
Financial Security Analysis.
I was going to say the analyzer, yes. Financial Security Analysis.
Financial Security Analysis. And I taught advisors to be able to do these calculations on the fly instead of having to send them to their company in the sky somewhere in New York or whatever, and 3 weeks later getting back a plan. Your advisor should be able to do this on the fly. So if you're going to lose $25,000 in Social Security benefits, you know, for the next, you know, 20 potential years.
In other words, your spouse dies, that was income you were counting on.
Yeah, what do you think that's worth? Just a ballpark.
$25,000 a year.
$25,000 a year for the next 20 years.
Well, I mean, it's got to be $500,000.
Yeah, $400,000 or $500,000, depending on, because that's an inflation-adjusted annuity, basically Social Security.
Well, it is.
Losing one of those benefits is like losing a lot. Now, in my case, my benefit is 3 or 4 times higher than my wife's benefit. So obviously, if we want to replace Social Securities, she would want to have an insurance policy, or I would want to have an insurance policy on her. That's about 1/3 of the insurance policy on me if I wanted to maintain the same lifestyle if she were to die before me. But actuarially speaking, that ain't going to happen.
No, it isn't going to happen. Now, you're a little bit better off if you have if there's a big disparity in Social Security.
Yes.
Because the lower one will always drop off no matter who dies.
That's correct.
The problem is when you've got two Social Securities that are almost the same.
So we're talking about risk management here. And if you were to identify, you sit down with your financial advisor, and before you start talking about asset allocation and stocks and bonds and options and ETFs and all of that stuff, I know it's hard. It's going to be really hard for your financial advisor. But if they're worth their salt, they're going to ask you some of the tough questions, like, what plans have you made in the event one or the other of you end up needing home health care or nursing home care or some form of long-term care that incidentally is not covered by Medicare? Nobody wants to talk about that. It's actually, when you're younger and healthier, it's a pretty easy risk to manage. And when you're older, it's next to impossible because you can't qualify for benefits. But there are ways to address it. There are lots of different options, but your advisor has to have the discussion with you, or you with he or she, to manage those risks. So I want you to write down on a yellow tablet, because that's what I like doing, all of the risks that you face in your latter years, and then talk to your advisor about how you can manage them. We'll be back. And welcome back. This is the Ray Shields Show, helping you to make better money moves with Johnny Dean, the bad boy of radio and television.
Yeah, and by the way, we'll get to a couple of emails coming up here in not too long, probably next segment. I had one that from Orlando who was asking, I think we talked about it earlier in the hour. Hold on, Orlando. It has to do with IUL, Index Universal Life Insurance.
We'll get to that. Yeah, yes. And in fact, we have been talking about insurance. We're also going to get to the psychology of retirement income, an interesting study out of Dr. Michael Fink coming up. But I want to finish our thought on this whole business of risk management, because I challenge you during the break to write down some of the risks, or at least commit them to memory.
Yes, okay, so there's a risk that, these are ones really everybody faces, but let's say a married couple, one of them could die, there's the risk of death, and
yeah,
one of them will
go
first.
Yeah, so the first thing you gotta do is you gotta pull out your calculator and say, you know, if you want to make sure she has, you know, 50 grand a year for 10 years, mm-hmm. or whatever, at 3%, that's $426,000. If you want to make sure that the mortgage is paid off, there's another $200,000 or $300,000. You probably need $1 million worth of coverage, John Boy.
Right. And so if I'm young and I can afford it, that's fine. But, you know, it starts to get costly if I'm thinking about this in my late 50s, early 60s.
You're a cheapskate. Well, what if it's $50 a month? I mean, you can buy term insurance for $50 a month or something, probably for $1 million.
Well, but I mean, maybe I need this to last for longer than a term.
Well, you got to start somewhere, dude.
Well,
let's go on to the next one, because I know I've had this conversation with you before.
All right, so you got the
there's
disability.
Death and
disability.
That's an important one in long-term care. We've talked about that.
Yes, we have.
You could end up in a nursing home somewhere.
Yes, that could happen, and it could happen anytime.
Outliving your life expectancy. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. We talked about that during the break. How about this one? You could lose your job.
Could happen. Could happen.
And that really is important, because we've discussed having emergency funds, and they've become very unpopular when interest rates were so low. But today, you know, they're not as bad. You can put the money in a money market fund or a CD and get a couple of percent. So it's better than a poke in the eye. So having some cash sitting around is good. Having access to cash, like that IUL discussion, that's what I used for years. I used my life insurance policies, mm-hmm. and I used a second mortgage, a line of credit on my, you don't like my Diet Mountain Dew sitting on the desk.
I didn't know how to signal you. I'm sorry, but go ahead.
We use the same studio for radio as we do for television.
And we forget sometimes we're on television.
We put the Diet Mountain Dew on the set.
Unless they want to sponsor the show, you know.
You know, it's great. It tears your guts up, and my wife says it makes you fat because it's fake sugar and all that stuff.
It doesn't make you fat.
But it does replace 14 cups of coffee.
There you go, which I think is better. All right, so you said you use IUL.
Loss of job.
Yes.
Getting divorced, all of those. So but the point that I was making, I need to move on. The point that I was making is sit down with your advisor and list all these things out, right, on one side of the sheet, draw a line down the middle, and then list out how you have addressed them. And if there's a goose egg next to it, in other words, you haven't addressed it, get that done before you start talking about asset allocation and stocks and bonds. That's all, because it's way more important. Way more important.
I agree.
Okay, I want to get to this Michael Fink study. Very, very interesting. He's the chief academic officer at the American College of Financial Services. And what he talked about is the mental separation of wealth and income. This is really fascinating, because so many of us strive to be wealthy, but when we get to retirement, wealth has very little to do with it. It's more about how much am I spending? Check this out. So Dr. Fink highlighted that an important distinction exists between wealth and income. People have trouble spending their assets, not spending their income. Once we start viewing money as wealth, as a stock of money, and not necessarily as a flow of money, then we seem to get less happiness out of spending it than we do from money that's automatically turned into flow. Now, we kind of knew this intuitively, but now it's been proven out in the science labs all across the country. The data shows an inflection point when individuals have somewhere between $3 million and $4 million saved. Fink explained that people will naturally focus on a number. For example, you want to get to $500,000 by the day that you retire, and it becomes negatively affected when that number decreases, even if it does not decrease until years after retirement. So in other words, people get focused on this number, John. I want to have $1 million when I retire, and then I'll be happy. Well, when it's $999,000, I'm not happy anymore. That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
But what's more important is this. People spend income, not assets. That's why this whole idea of I'll liquidate some stocks to live on is bogus, because the studies indicate that you won't. In addition to refocusing individuals' retirement income perspectives, advisors have a variety of investment vehicles and products available to them to turn pools of wealth into guaranteed streams of income. Obviously, Social Security is one of those guaranteed streams of income.
Because it's not coming from a big pile of savings, it's just income.
Defined benefit plans used to be, but now they've been steadily on the decline for the last, say, 25 years. Most companies don't have defined benefit pension plans any longer. Social Security, as I said, he goes on, remains a source of guaranteed income for 97% of the population between the ages of 60 and 89. So what are the strategies for turning assets into guaranteed income? He says build a bond ladder. Now, we've discussed this in the past. When you have a bond ladder, you might have bonds. Let's say it's a 10-year bond ladder, and you'll have bonds that mature every year, year one, then two, then three, then four, all the way out to year 10. And after the first year, you buy a new 10-year bond. After the second year, you buy a new 10-year bond, so that you always have bonds maturing. And that's a decent way for you to create income. So when the bond matures, you can take your income from the bond that is maturing, and you always would have one that's maturing the year after and the year after. Annuities, we've discussed a million times on this program. That's probably the easiest thing. I recall a study done by Dr. Wade Fowle on bond ladders versus annuitized income, and it was actually cheaper to fund retirement with an annuity than a bond ladder. Well, that would make sense because of something called mortality credits, right, John? You know what they are.
I know what they are. It's where the insurance company digs into its pocket to keep paying you, grumble, 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 because you live so long.
So the old people get to crib off of the dead people.
Well, dead people don't care. They don't need it, you know. That's the whole point, though.
Here's another thing that happens in real life, and I see it all the time. In fact, I get at least a question or two a month on should I take the annuity from my company or should I take the lump sum?
Oh, yeah.
Now, you need to understand that most of the annuities from the company are based on some actuarial calculation. So they're real live numbers done by actuaries that say, if you're 68 years old and you've accumulated $582,000, we'll give you the $582,000 or we'll give you $6,282 a month for the rest of your life. I'm making those numbers
whatever
up.
Whatever it is. It's different for everybody.
But you must understand that annuity calculation can be skewed one way or the other based on your own personal circumstance. Remember the other day, John, I talked about how certain individuals that are wealthier and healthier can game the system. Those individuals ought to definitely take the annuity because they get the mortality credit benefit, right? If you're going to live longer than the other person in the pool, then you get the benefit of that person dying early. But here's the rub. Most financial planners and advisors say, well, let's take the lump sum because we can invest this money, get 10%, pay you out that $6,000, and we'll have $3,000 or $4,000 left over for inflation or for your heirs or whatever. And what they do not understand is this thing called the sequence of returns risk. When you purchase the company's annuity. And by the way, it's usually not the company's annuity. They de-risk their portfolios more and more today by going to an insurance company. Now, some of the big companies, they basically finance it out of their pocket. They get the actuaries, they tell them how much the annuity would be, and they take the investment risk themselves.
Most don't, though, right?
Most of the really, really big
companies. Well, no, the big companies would, but most companies.
But more and more companies. I read an article the other day where MetLife, I think, said more companies are de-risking because they've done really well. They're not underfunded anymore. And now they want to de-risk and transfer that risk to an insurance company, which is exactly what an annuity does. Welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show, helping you to make better money moves live on your radio and television nationwide and coast to coast. Emails, raylucia.com. Click on the Ask Ray button. I answer every single one of them, Johnny.
Yeah.
Personally.
Sometimes a little late if I don't get to it on time. So we're going to go right here to Orlando, who's been waiting like an hour for this
one. Well, hit it, fellas. Let's do some emails. Postman's out there.
Orlando says, I'm considering an IUL, Index Universal Life.
Yes.
For insurance and retirement savings. Is this a good move? I'm 43, married with two kids.
Well, Orlando, it may be and it may not be. And I wish I could give you a little bit better advice. Let me first explain to everybody what's going on here. So an Index Universal Life is a permanent life insurance policy where you put money in, you pay a premium. The premium goes toward buying term life insurance and the balance goes into a side fund. The side fund is invested like it would be in, say, an index annuity. And the interest that you earn on that side fund would be based upon how well an index like the Standard & Poor's 500 does, with zero downside risk, but some kind of a cap on the upside. Now, I will point out that the caps are in the double-digit returns on an IUL, so they actually will perform a little bit better than most indexed annuities, per se. But then there's the expense of the mortality charges and all of that stuff. Now, who are they good for? They're good for individuals who obviously need life insurance, because you don't buy life insurance if you don't need it. They're good for individuals that are in reasonably high income tax brackets, because a life insurance policy grows on a tax-deferred basis like a Roth, and you can withdraw your principal tax-free like a Roth, and you can borrow your earnings out tax-free like a Roth. So it's kind of like a Roth IRA with a death benefit, although a little bit more expensive. Your age, Orlando, maybe it cost you 1% over the long time period to have a permanent death benefit. So it's not a bad deal. Now, Johnny, several of them now come with chronic illness or critical care riders, where if it's a $500,000 policy, you may be able to tap into $200,000 or $300,000 of the death benefit tax-free if something emergent happens to you. You lose your health or whatever. There's disability waiver of premiums. But these are complex instruments. They're not right for everybody. But I hearken back to Dr. Fowle's study where he talks about using permanent life insurance along with a life annuity. And this is academically proven out. So everybody ought to at least take a look at this. Not everybody should do it, but everybody should explore it. If you die early, the life insurance takes care of your family. If you live too long, the annuity takes care of you and your family. And the combination of the two of those with a normal stock and bond portfolio for the balance of your allocation actually produced significantly better results for both income and legacy. Don't believe me? I'll be talking about it sometime, probably in the next week or so. It's phenomenal stuff. So Orlando, for you, I can't say, because if you're running tight, financially, doesn't make sense.
If he hasn't maxed out his 401k or his Roth,
obviously,
don't do it.
You need to talk to a financial advisor, because it doesn't make sense for everybody, but it might make sense for you.
Elliot says, I read that index funds are the best way to go, but mine got killed in December. Do you think there is a better way to go?
You know, anytime we start talking about better ways to go and we jump from one to the other, it's usually a mistake. But let's go back a step. An index fund, why is it the best way to go? It's not because there's stellar asset management, because there is no asset management. When you buy an index, you're buying all of the stocks within a certain category, like the Standard & Poor's 500. You get all the big companies in America and you take your chances, right? And they're usually market capitalization weighted, meaning more of your money goes to the bigger companies and less of your money goes to the smaller companies. So they're weighted more toward large. Well, that's panned out pretty well over the last few years with, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Netflix and the technology stocks doing as well as they've done. Amazon, just phenomenal companies. But they also fell pretty hard last year, too, in many respects. And you've seen a couple of instances where Facebook's, you know, done some things that people don't like, and all of a sudden they get a bad rap and the stock gets creamed. Apple even got creamed, right? So those big companies can make you a lot of money in an index. They can cost you a lot of money. But the reason index funds are so attractive is because they're dirt cheap, because you don't have to pay for a money manager. Now, what would I do? I'm a firm believer in, and I've said this before, I'd rather be 50% right than 100% wrong. I've written about this. There have been instances, maybe 40, 50% of the time, where those top money managers do, in fact, beat the index. You can look up something called active share. For me, I'd rather have a portfolio that had some index, which is broad diversification, and then some concentration, where maybe there's 10, 15, 20 stocks in a portfolio. Now, understand, 20 stocks can be a lot riskier than 500 stocks, but it can also do a better job when the markets are, and those particular companies are in favor. But you're right, Johnny, when the market is tumbling and you own an index fund, you're tumbling along with it.
Well, because you're mirroring, in many respects, the index. I mean, this is what happens. The index goes down, you're going to go down as well. And as you said, the 50-50 rule or guideline, whatever you want to call it, can mitigate some of that loss somewhat.
Well, here's the biggest problem. The biggest problem is how you behave. Because whether index funds do better than active management or active management does better than index funds, hey, I think most of the time you will find that index funds do fine. But the index fund investor is where the problem lies, and he's hinting at that right now, because he's saying, well, you know what, I got killed. Yeah, he got killed last year. Well, you and
well, in
I
December
and
alone.
Everybody else. Yeah, well, we're down like 8-9% in 1 month. So the fact is, Elliot, you need to manage your behavior more than you need to oversight an index fund. And that's where I'll leave it. In the meantime, folks, if you want to email me, go to raylucia.com, R-A-Y-L-U-C-I-A.com. Click on the Ask Ray button. Now make it a blessed day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions. Ray is available to take your questions online at Ray Lucia.